Good morning. Trust me, believe me when I say it's good to see you. I missed you last week.
And we missed you.
But I'm glad you're here. Totally am. Mason, you pulled that up. 1988, Melody and I took a little vacation. This is BC, before children. We went up to Glacier National Park, which is in Upper Montana, and actually made our way for a little while into Waterton National Park, which is the Canadian side of Glacier. So it was absolutely beautiful. It was during that season, however, that one of the largest wildfires in America has ever burned. It was Yellowstone. Again, 1988. Fire started with a lightning strike. And the people that know these things, right, said, let's just let it burn. What a good idea. Let's just, you know, get rid of some of the undergrowth. Until the winds picked up and it was seriously hot and nothing could contain it. So as Melody and I are driving back from Glacier, the fires were still burning in Yellowstone, but they opened up part of the park, which was fascinating. We just decided, hey, let's go. And this is something that we saw. Is that crazy? That's not a great camping experience right there, by the way. It gets a little warm. Things are going to move. Go ahead and click to the next one. I don't have a clicker, so go ahead and move to the next one. The trees burst when they catch fire. Pine trees, anyway. And this was phenomenal to watch. To stop and to stare was not what was protocol in the park at that time. Driving through was what was protocol. But we went through and stopped and saw. Go ahead, click the next one. Just outrageous stuff. Burned it burned thousands, tens of thousands of acres to the ground. Go ahead, Mason, the next one. So I want to talk to you this morning about fire and glory. Click. One of the realities is, as I put it up here, there's a vast difference between knowledge of something and experience of something. When we were children, I'm going to guess most of you in the adolescent adult world knew that putting your finger in the socket on the wall was not a good idea, but you had to experience it to know for certain, right? There's a vast difference between knowing something and experiencing something. Go ahead and click again. So knowledge alone does not bring transformation. You can know something to be true, but it doesn't change who you are. It has to include experience. Knowledge and experience go hand in hand. So I ask this question. Go ahead and click. The question is this. What is the difference between your knowledge of God and your experience of God? You would have to think about that and answer it for yourself. What is the difference between your knowledge of God, the things that you've learned about God, the things you've discovered about God, reading His Word, looking into creation, and your experience of God? We've gone from the outside to the inside. The experience goes deeper within. It's out of your head now and into your heart. You can click that out. If you would, turn with me to the book of Zechariah. Because I believe that there are overwhelming benefits to experiencing God. Overwhelming benefits to experiencing God, not just knowing who God is. You know, Jesus in one of his parables was talking about the reality that at the end of time, a grouping of people will come and say, but Jesus, didn't we know you? Didn't we do these marvelous things in your name? And he lists off some of those things that seem pretty altruistic. And then Jesus said to me, to them, go away from me. We've never had an experience together. You know about me. You don't know me. That experience was necessary in order for them to bring salvation to its ultimate place of rest. What is your difference between your knowledge of God and your experience of God? Chapter 2, Old Testament book of Zechariah. Hopefully you've found it by now. It's one of the 12 minor prophets. Don't let minor deceive you in any way. Minor just simply means they didn't last as long as some of the other guys. Isaiah, for example, prophesied during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. You do the math, it's about 60 years. Zechariah, yeah, a year, right? That's why he's called minor. But it does not lessen the impact of his book. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a man with a measuring line. He had a tape measure in his hand. So I said, "Where are you going?" And he said to me, "To measure Jerusalem." We're going to get down to brass tacks here. We're going to find out how wide it is, how long it is, how tall it is, right? And behold, the angel who was speaking with me was going out, and another angel was coming out to meet him. So you have this picture of Zechariah talking with this angel. This angel is about to ready to go do his job when another angel comes out. And so now he's seeing two of them, and they're having this little dialogue together. And he said, "Run, speak to that young man, saying, Jerusalem will be inhabited without walls, because of the multitude of men and cattle within it. For I, declares the Lord," hear this, "for I, declares the Lord, will be a wall of fire around them, and I will be the glory in her midst." That's an experience of God. I want to talk to you this morning about the fire of God and the glory of God. An unwalled city was not a city you wanted to live in. It was vulnerable. It was exposed. It was very dangerous. An unwalled city was not where you wanted to be. And it's interesting that regularly in the Old Testament, when this word wall occurs, it has an adjective, surrounding. A wall surrounding, or a surrounding wall. The implication is that what is encompassed in the entire city makes it impregnable to enemy forces. There is a cocoon feeling. There is this safety feeling. I want to give you two extremes from ancient days. First of all, were the walls of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar the Great stood on top of his palace and looked out over the city of Babylon and said, "Is this not Babylon the Great, which I have built with my own hands?" Not likely. He had it built. The dimensions of Babylon's walls were thus. They were three in number, an outer, a middle, and an inner. All three walls reached 40 feet in height and were wide enough for two chariots to have a race on the top. Three of those. When Babylon was conquered by the Persian army, they never, ever went over, around, through, into, under the wall. They actually went through the water system of the river that ran through the middle of the city. The walls made the city impregnable. Speaking of Persia, the other end of the extreme is Pasargadae, which was the capital of the Persian Empire during the time of Cyrus the Great. And it was the first city in the ancient world that had no walls surrounding it. His idea, Cyrus the Great's idea, was really this freedom to come in and out, to experience pleasure and joy and safety of just being. So you can imagine when Alexander the Great came with his there's no walls. They cleaned up that city in one night. One night. To the Jew, they were in the middle. They had walls, but they were made out of stone. They were made out of wood. And they were susceptible. The breach could occur. Destruction could happen. And Jerusalem has been destroyed on a number of occasions. But God said, "Here's the deal. They won't need to build a wall because I will build the wall. I will be the wall. I will be," he says, "a wall of fire around, surrounding them." Fire is used throughout Scripture as a description of God. His essential character. Now, I've only done a few, but I want you to listen to these. Genesis chapter 15, verse 17. Abraham had an encounter with God. It was during the time that his covenant was being made, Genesis chapter 17, and it says that God had Abraham take some animals and some birds, and he cut them in half and made a pathway between them. And at sunset, this fire pot came down the middle. God's presence as flame came down the middle, signifying the ratification of the covenant. Move forward to Exodus chapter 3. Moses is out in the wilderness. And he's tending sheep. He has run away, right? He's living a life of hiding at this juncture. And what should happen before his very eyes? Something burning. Something burning that doesn't burn up. It intrigued him. He came closer to discover that the fire was God. So powerful and holy was his presence that Moses had to take off his shoes. A little further on, Exodus chapter 13, we read that God was leading the nation of Israel through the wilderness from Egypt on the way to the promised land with a pillar of fire. Pillar of fire. In fact, that pillar of fire was at the tail end during the time they were at the edge of the Red Sea. And what that pillar did was provide that necessary barrier between the approaching Egyptian army and a defenseless people. The fire of God was there. Exodus chapter 24, verse 17. How about Mount Sinai? How about Mount Sinai? When the people came where the law was given, Moses went up on the mountain, and what you have is this cloud, but it's a cloud that you can see the flames and lightning coming through it. It was the powerful presence of God depicted in flame. Not the least of which, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 4. Our God is a consuming fire. Our God is a consuming fire. So powerful is that statement, so profound is that statement in the mind of a Jewish person, that in the book of Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews quotes that in chapter 12, verse 29. For our God is a consuming fire. Now, I want to give you a Greek lesson. Okay, you can take notes if you want. If you have a powerful memory, use it. But I want to give you a little Greek lesson this morning. There is no Greek word for the word a chair, a car, a house, a storm. That does not exist. Not even in conceptually does the word a ever run through a Greek person's mind. The word the does. The chair, the car, the house, that does occur. And here's the difference. When there is a the there, that the says that one. It's an identifier. It's specific. It's saying that one right there. Not over there. Not that one over there. Not that one in the block ahead. It's that chair right there, the chair. It's specific, it's focused, it's identified, it's the subject. But when there's an absence of the word the, and we just have chair, what the Greek mind thought was all of the characteristics that accompany what it means to be a chair is there. And it could be there, and it could be there. It's not a chair, it's just what we would understand chairness to be, right? Now, the reason why I'm telling you this is it's significant. Because the New World Translation, which is the Jehovah's Witness version of the Bible, has added that little word a where it doesn't exist. And it always is translated before God. Something like this. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was a God. That's how it's translated. Pick it out. Look. Find a New World Translation. What's fascinating is they don't even abide by their own rules. John 1:1, God there does not have a definite article. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, And then it says, and God was the Word, literally. The Word was a God. They supply that, little a. So what they have done is they have taken the majesty and the grandeur and the splendor of the God and has made it something that could occur or pop up anywhere. But see, that's not even good Greek, right? That's not even a good thought in a Greek person's mind, because they're thinking about what is the totality of what it means to be God. All the characteristics and qualities and the essence of His person, what that means. And I told you they don't translate it the same, because the same arrangement occurs in chapter 1, verse 14 of John. And to all who received Him, to those who believed in His name, He gave the right to become children of God. That's how the New World Translation translates it, and accurately so. But there's no definite article before God. So just as they did in chapter 1, verse 1, they should have done in chapter 14, or 1, verse 14. It would come out, and to those who received Him, to those who believed in His name, He gave the right to become children of a God. How significant is that little word, a? We have it in English. Doesn't exist in the Greek. I tell you that because here's the truth. When you look at Hebrew, Hebrews chapter 12, verse 29, it says, our God, the God, is a consuming fire. A has to be supplied because it doesn't exist. So literally, it is our God consuming fire. The totality of our God, the God, consuming fire. It's His essence. That's who He is. That is the reality of our God. So this God, this consuming fire, and that's how He is self-identified, by the way, in the book of Isaiah, chapter 30, 33, on and on. God identifies Himself as consuming fire. This is who I am. This is not something about me. This is my essence. This is who I am. That who I am, in Deuteronomy 9, verse 3, said, I, as a consuming fire, will go ahead of you across the Jordan into the promised land. Do you think that's a powerful picture? They didn't just, you know, pack their weapons on their hips and follow across the water and get to the promised land. And it says that the consuming fire went ahead of them. That would make me bold and courageous, would it not, you? 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 38 is the event that Ezekiel. I'm getting ahead of myself because I'm so excited. Elijah had this experience on Mount Carmel. Well, he called 450 prophets of Baal to have this little showdown, right? And they both built an altar. And the 450 prophets of Baal did their thing and put their sacrifice and did whatever they did around here. And nothing happened. And Elijah didn't have a watch, but I bet he went, you know, I'm going to give this another 2 hours. We're just going to see what happens, right? And he just kind of kicked back and watched and see what was going on. Towards the evening sacrifice, around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he went into motion. He started his business. So he built his altar and he put the sacrifice on it. But more than that, he had one of the servants go over and get water. 1, 2, 3, 7 times. Not just a little bucket of water, but a container that would probably pour out 5 gallons. So you're looking at 35 gallons of water on top of this sacrifice. Then he prays and it says, the consuming fire of heaven descended and ate up the water and the sacrifice and the altar. What was left? A scorched spot on the ground. I remember doing some rock climbing when I was a younger man, and we had climbed up on this dome rock. It was really beautiful. It's in outside of Colorado Springs. And on the top of this dome rock are purple lines etched in the rock. Lightning strikes. Scorched the rock. I mean, left an impression on the rock. The fire, the consuming fire of God for Elijah in answering his prayer, came down and took it all and left an etch on the ground. Our God is a consuming fire. Negatively, remember Nadab and Abihu, the two oldest sons of Aaron, when they became priests, did something against the rules, right? They were doing this sacrifice that God demanded their way, not God's way. And when they approached the tent of meeting, the consuming fire came down and killed them. Dead. Right on the door. God says, I am a consuming fire around them. I am a wall of fire around them. What does that mean? It means God. God is a fiery character. He is bent, tent, driven to protect, to destroy. Soon, to transform, refine, to judge, to guide. I experienced this. I am pretty certain, not on a limb, but I'm pretty certain that all this fireplace campfire. Let's go campfire. The evening, and you have a ring. Inevitably, people are drawn to the flame. It's mesmerizing, isn't it? You're watching. You're engulfed with it. And there's these interesting things going on. You're watching the wonder of flame and at the same time understanding the danger inherent. That fire has to be contained because it would literally destroy everything in its path. I showed you some pictures of what that looks like. But we're mesmerized. We're lost in it. And you know what else is fascinating about a campfire? It begins to draw something out of us. How many conversations go to a deeper place because you're sitting around a campfire together? It's coming out. I'm saying all this for a reason, because if God is truly consuming fire, then one of the realities we would embrace is, yes, He's mesmerizing. There's power there. There's authority there. There's dominion there. It's an untouchable situation. And yet it draws something out of me. It's a longing. It's a longing to get what's broken fixed. It's a longing to get what's wounded healed. It's a longing to find joy and delight where life has been crushing and sorrowful. It's this invitation, come out. I will be a wall of fire around them. And what I find fascinating in this passage is it isn't a fixed wall. Babylon fixed its boundaries, right? Three walls. There's the city. If you want to add suburbs, because you're going to stay in the wall. But God is a wall of fire, is this, right? Expanding, moving, accommodating. It's accommodating of the city. What's fire? More animals coming in. More reality coming in. More people coming in. And not just Jewish people, but Gentiles. God's when He's bringing all people and people, which we saw in Revelation, into His domain, is God's domain. Is it this place marks off the true territory where God is? Involvement in Israel. It's not just passive, which is really as strange as it is. Fire is active. It's a chemical reaction. All the matter in the universe is constant. It doesn't go away. It just changes form. So what you're chemically in, you're watching wood turn into smoke and H2O, and you have flame, carbon dioxide. All that's transpiring in there is this chemical reaction. changing. Let's involve. God is saying, declaring, I am your history. I am a wall around you. It is protection. Yes, it is. It is enlightening. It is destroying all that is wrong and broken. Yes, it is. But I want you to know that I have chosen you, and I'm going to be with you to transform. For us as His followers, let's admit together that there is a precarious nature to a life of faith in a fallen world. We are living really without walls, without barriers, in a hostile environment. We need a wall of protection because the world is bent against us. It is dangerous. It is scary. It is exposing. But a life of faith says, I choose to live in that world knowing that my God is a consuming fire around me. So I can choose to live vulnerably. I can learn to live vulnerably. And what it does is it opens the doors of trust. Trusting God for His involvement in my history. In the journey of my life. What is being written about my life. God is choosing to be a part of that journey. And it ebbs and flows. It moves about. And as my faith grows, so do the walls that are around me to accompany the growth. But the fire never leaves. The wall of fire never leaves. So when we read, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you, it's more than just a neat little saying on a ceramic little angel. It's a that says, I surround you like a wall of fire. Because I am fire itself. A consuming fire. Then he goes on to say, and I will be glory in their midst. Glory has taken some hits in our culture, so let's go back to sort of some originals, right? Kabod, Old Testament word for glory, means heaviness or weighty. Thus, it meant something that was truly, truly important. Something that was incredibly worthy. New Testament, doxa. By the way, we get the English word doxology from this word. So sometimes at the end of the service, we sing what's known as the doxology. It literally is a word of glory, is exactly what it means, a word of glory. It means a true apprehension of things, understanding things as they really are. Understand that. We live in a culture where truth is compromised. Truth has become relative. Truth is what each of us determine truth to be. It's become very subjective. But truth, because of its very nature, is objective. It's that which God declares to be true, and we go, that's true. And so I'm going to live my life by what is true, not by what I want to make up so that I think it's true. So many in our culture have followed the lies of the enemy and are deceived into believing something that is so untrue. It is so untrue. It's messing up their lives. It's taking them out. More than just that which is true. It is that which is true of God. Of His unchanging essence. Of majesty. Of radiance. Take this as an example. The Gospels it is declared, by the glory of God, Jesus rose from the dead. It was God's glory that rose Jesus from the dead. Whew. Let's take that out of our head and put it in our heart, right? Because our mind is going, what does that mean? The glory of God rose Jesus from the grave means this. The full power, the full beauty, the full worth, the full significance, the full potency, the full reputation of God was involved in raising Jesus Christ from the dead. Glory. Exodus chapter 33, one of my favorite passages in Scripture. Lewis and I have talked about it, actually. Moses has led the people out of Egypt. They're still on journey. He's had these interesting encounters with God. Let's call them experiences. And he gets to this place where he goes, God, let me see your glory. Let me see your glory. And God accommodates that, right? God hides him in a rock and puts his hand over his face, right? And he walks by and then he moves his hand and he gets to see God passing by. And it was so powerful. It left an impression. Let me see your potency, your majesty, your splendor, your greatness, your character. That very next chapter, Exodus chapter 34, is one of seven occurrences where God in this manner. God revealed himself in his glory as I am a gracious and compassionate God. That means this God of glory, this God of potency, this God of splendor, God of power, God of significance is gracious. I am a God of compassion. Which really beautiful marriage between grace and compassion, because grace is not treating us like we deserve it. Right? Some of you have experienced grace. You're driving down the highway. All of a sudden you see lights behind you. You pull over to the side. They ask you this terrible question. Do you know how fast you were going? Right? And if you're wise, you'll say, yeah, I know. I was going 6 miles over the speed limit or 8 miles over the speed limit or whatever it is. Grace says, I'm going to let you off with a warning this time. You didn't deserve that. You deserved the ticket. You deserved having to pay $295 or whatever it is for speeding 10 miles over the speed limit, right? That's justice. That's what's being rightfully served, but you've been given grace. I'm going to let you go this time with a warning. And God does that over and over and over. I'm going to give you things you don't deserve. Over and over, I'm going to just lavish you with things you don't deserve. You can't earn these. You don't deserve them. I'm giving them to you, grace. I'm a God of compassion because I feel for you. I love the word in the New Testament. The word compassion, which literally means bowels. So it says when Jesus had compassion on the crowds, literally we would read it, and Jesus had bowels on the crowd. But what it is this visceral feeling from deep within that cares and has a longing for restoration and gentleness. That's who God is. It's this God that from the very depths, the core of his wonder because of his grace. I'm a gracious God. I am a compassionate God. I am a God that's slow to anger. That is not the concept that most people in America have of God. They see God as either aloof, distant, or he's a God that has a vendetta against your life, and he doesn't want you to enjoy anything about life. And he looks down on you, and you start to enjoy something, and he takes his foot, and he stomps on it, and goes, you can't have fun. And that's how they begin to see God. But God says, I'm slow to anger. I'm slow to anger. I can take it. Some of you have been mad at God. He can take it. Some of you have pouted with God. He can take it. Some of you have just kind of went, you know what, God, I'm going to do whatever I want, and you can't do anything about it. Well, you can, but we're deceiving ourselves at that point. And what is God? Slow to anger. I'm still here. I don't like what you're doing. I don't like your behavior. I think your attitude stinks, but I'm here. I'm here. Furthermore, he says, I am a God that is forgiving. Not only is he slow to anger and gracious and compassionate, he's forgiving. Forgiving. I will tell you from experience and from my experience as a pastor that more people have a problem forgiving themselves than accepting God's forgiveness. And you know what? That doesn't work. You can't accept God's forgiveness and not forgive yourself. You cannot accept God's forgiveness and not forgive yourself. He's a forgiving God. Here's the last one. Abounding in loving kindness. Usually it's plural. Loving kindnesses. And we've rehearsed this word over and over. There is no English equivalent to it. It's a word that has so much meaning to it that we can't. If we say one thing, we leave out something else, right? So it's love, it's kindness, it's mercy, it's grace, it's compassion. It's all of loving kindness is just everything that God is thrown into a word, right? That's who I am. That is my glory in your midst. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 11, which we've quoted a lot of times about a people returning to God. God's glory is associated with power and victory. It's not a passive mamby-pamby thing, this glory of God. It is power and majesty and victory. I love in Isaiah, the latter chapters, 42, 45, 48, where God declares, I am God, and there's no other. So put that out of your mind. There isn't anybody else. It says, I am a God of glory, and I will not share my glory with anyone else. This glory of God is unique to God. You won't find it anywhere else. Look for it all over this planet to the very ends of the universe. You will not find anything that matches the glory of God. But what's always been fascinating to me, John chapter 1. John says, we saw him. We saw this word become flesh. We saw this God-man. We saw this Jesus fellow. We saw him. We saw him. We heard him. We touched him. We laughed with him. We ate with him. So we saw this. We beheld, John says, his glory. The glory of the one and only from the Father, full of grace and truth. The very things that I just told you about that define glory, the disciples, especially John, go, oh, that's it. It went from a written page to an experience. It went from the knowledge of God to an encounter with God. It went from this idea, this concept of who God is as a glorious God and brought it into the place of the personal. And he said, I saw his glory. Glory. I saw it. I experienced it. One of my favorite concepts of this idea of God's glory is found in Isaiah chapter 4, verse 5. Where God declares, I will be, my glory will be a canopy over them. So get this picture. I am a wall of fire around them. And my glory is a canopy over them. That's the truth of who God is. This is the truth of who God is. However, and you must ask yourself, how many times do we go, that's cool, and we walk out? The fire's over there. The glory is over there, and we're over here. And then we go, God, help me. God, save me. God, I'm in this tough.